Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm happy now to welcome Geshe Lobsang Tenzin. He is the director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership at Emory University, and he is co-director of the Emory-Tibet Science Initiative and the Emory Collaborative for Contemplative Studies. He studied at the Drepung Losaling Monastery in India, and we've been talking to the monks from that monastery here on this program last week, and he earned his PhD at Emory University with a focus on traditional Buddhist and contemporary Western approaches. And he will be giving a workshop this Saturday, December 19th, here in Santa Fe, from 3 to 5 in the afternoon, called The Healing Power of Compassion, Insights from the Convergence of Modern Science and Buddhist Science of Mind. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are a professor at Emory, and you co-authored a scientific study on the effects of compassion meditation on neuroendocrine, immune, and behavioral responses to stress. What did that study find?
The study that we conducted here at Emory University for over 3-4 years with the undergraduate students, actually that we found a number of things. That one, the difference in the level of IL-6 is an immune cell, what is known as interleukin or IL-6, often correlated with our modern-day illnesses like depression and the strokes and the heart disease and like that. The meditation group, particularly the meditation group that spent significant time in meditation, what we call the high practice group, actually that group showed a significantly lower amount of IL-6 in response to a stressor, which is a really good sign that the immune response is better and that they cope the stresses better. But also we found that the cortisol, which is a stress hormone, again, that high levels of cortisol is linked with many of our illnesses. So there again, that high practice group should lower cortisol levels in response to a stressor. And also the subjective kind of the reporting of the distress that is in terms of depression or the hostility and just how they feel about others and the life. And that also was in the meditation, high meditation practice group, you know, that their level of distress seemed to be much lower. So in all these three areas, high meditation practice group seemed significantly different than the control and the low practice group.
These are people who were practicing over a period of time, but certainly you can't really compare them to Tibetan monks who practice for many, many years at a time. When you look at the population of monks, and I know you probably haven't done a scientific study on this, but do you see that they tend to get fewer diseases than Westerners?
Yeah, first of all, the meditation that these students were doing here, you know, the duration was just for 6 weeks. And as I mentioned, that the high practice and the low practice group, that when we divided the practice group in two, the high practice group really is the group that has spent anywhere from 500 or more minutes within that 6-week period, which is relatively a small amount of time. But even with such a short amount of time or a small amount of time that they spend, it seemed to show quite a difference from the others. And now you can imagine that those meditators who have spent like the years, some there are meditators who have spent a whole life, practically 30, 40 years, and there are many who have spent at least 10,000 hours during their lifetime doing the meditations. One would think that that if you got to subject them to the imaging, that like the brain imaging and other measurements, they would show quite a difference. So we ourselves haven't done any study involving the long-term meditators here at Emory, but I know that other researchers like Richard Davidson in Wisconsin, I mean, who is really the kind of the pioneer or the leading, you know, scientist in the field of affective neuroscience, the leader in the study of meditation. They have, in fact, studied with a number of those long-term meditators. And I think that there was a study a couple of years ago that they published where they did compare the long-term meditators with just the novice ones. And, you know, in measuring what is known as the gamma wavelength of the brain, that it showed a very big difference between the long-term meditators and the novice ones.
In the study that you did, you had a high practice group and a lower practice group. How many minutes a day did the high practice group meditate?
The high practice group in that six-week period spent 500 minutes or more. You know, that not necessarily they were doing every day, but 500 or more, it's really like this. You know, the, per week, it's about 90 minutes. So it's not...
That's not very much.
Yeah,
So that it makes a real difference, even if people don't do it ever. Because my understanding from the meditation that I've studied and that I've read about is that you really have to do it every day for it to work. That turns out not totally to be the case.
I think that not necessarily every day. Of course, that doing it more consistently will help get any skill that we are trying to build, whether it is the meditation, compassion, or mindfulness. You know, it will make it faster and easier, more kind of the refined or the enhanced skill. But in our study, it shows that those students who spent about, you know, 90 minutes per week, really, like the 3-4 days where they meditated about 25 minutes or so, have a significantly different response to stress than those who spent less than 500 minutes in that six-week period, or those who did not meditate. But now, you know, that we are moving on to more extended kind of study. It's called the CALM study, compassion and attention, longitudinal meditation trend meditation. So this study that we are embarking upon for the next 5 years will compare compassion meditation to basic what is called the attentional training, like the shamatha in Sanskrit. It's a basic mindfulness meditation to control groups. So there will be three groups, the compassion meditation group, the attention training group, or the shamatha meditation group, and the control group. But that one, we are just going to be starting in January next year.
So I was reading this book that you recommended called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain by Sharon Begley. And actually, there was a copy of it over there at Surrett Gallery where the monks are making their sand mandala. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting was that many neuroscientists believe that the brain itself gives rise to what we call mind or consciousness. But it's pointed out in this book that the opposite is also true, that our mind can affect the physical brain itself. How does this work? Tell us about that phenomenon.
Well, I think that the traditional kind of position until not long ago was that we have very little control over our experiences or the mental states, you know, that brain states will give rise to certain experiences. So the brain states will affect our experience, but not the other way around. But the research now is shedding light that actually our experience, you know, like the thoughts, our attitudes or the certain mental states, the imaginations and like that, can actually change the brain structures and brain function. So it's not just the brain states that will automatically give rise to certain experiences, but we consciously can pay attention to certain experiences, certain mental states, and those mental states can actually change the very physical structure of the brain and its function. So we are in an age, actually, this knowledge is becoming more and more clear. I think that not too long ago, the scientists, I don't know where, but they have even found that how the monkeys, actually, that they learn to use their imagination to actually move the cursor of the computer to play video games. And it's amazing, that how when we have a certain thought, that it has certain kind of, it corresponds to or translates to certain neuroelectrical signals. And by, interfacing that with some computer that can register that neuroelectric signals, then can actually, manipulate the other things. So, it's beyond doubt now, that how our thoughts can actually affect our physiological changes, including brain function and its structures.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting in this book was that it revealed that the brains of Tibetan monks who were meditating are, in fact, different from those of ordinary people. What does that look like? What are the real differences there?
I think that there's much to be learned still, but I think that the initial findings, again, primarily coming from Richard Davidson's lab in Wisconsin, where they reported that when these long-term meditators, actually, that when they evoke compassion, that they found that in our brain, on the kind of the prefrontal cortex, on the front part of the brain, apparently on the right side, the hemisphere of the brain, the same kind of the region of the brain on the right side, when it is activated, that it's often correlated with negative kind of emotions like the anxiety and depression, fears and like that. Whereas the left side of that prefrontal cortex, that there is a certain the part that when activity is enhanced in that part of the brain, it is often correlated with the positive emotions like confidence and happiness and so forth. So they found that when these monks who have been meditating for many years, when they evoke compassion, that there was much stronger activation in the left part of the brain, and on the right hemisphere of the brain, on the prefrontal cortex there, that the activity decreased. So that kind of shows that how actually that through learning, through kind of training, how their brains function differently. And then if you look at the brain kind of the structure itself, I don't know if they have looked at or not, but it probably will show difference in terms of it, the more the connections or the thickness of the neural connectivity there in that part of the brain probably. And there are other studies that where they show that when people meditate, for example, the basic attention part, that meditation and the mindfulness, sort of attention, the training in attention, they find that the certain part of the brain associated with memory, actually, that it becomes the connection there becomes thicker, as a response to attention training or the meditation.
It can be argued that we're wired to think and behave in certain ways through our experience throughout the course of our evolutionary history. For example, the tendency to react to different people differently based on category. So somebody is a friend or enemy, they're predator or prey, and so on. And that's part of our makeup because it was once, and probably sometimes still is, adaptive for survival. But the Buddhist teachings challenge those ways of thinking, dividing up the world into friend and enemy. And through compassion meditation, you learn to practice universal compassion for all people, not just those who are your friends. And so here's my question. Do we have to totally rewire our brains to be that way? Or is the compassion wiring already there? What is being done and undone when we unlearn those evolutionary responses?
Well, I think that it's true that in the evolutionary time that certain responses have become kind of learned, and certainly that our ancestors or the, in terms of the you know, species, had to be able to differentiate what is dangerous for your health or life and what would promote, and be able to avoid, you know, those that are dangerous for your survival, and to approach towards the things that will contribute towards your survival. But I think that in terms of our ability to connect with others, that compassion or the empathy in it, the positive way of connecting with others, that also is in the various researchers today. For example, the very famous leading researcher here at Emory University, Franz De Waal, you know, who has been studying for over 30-some years in the primate population about the empathy part. Many of them, they seem to accept the position that we are also biologically, you know, the built to connect with others. And now, with regard to whether we need to completely not have any, you know, instinct or ability to feel any fear or the negativity towards others or not, I mean, that's a different question. But I think that we live in today's world where we are more and more, we get into the situation of that this anger and the dislike towards the people that we interact with, whether in the workplace or our neighbors or the, you know, that other people. And I think that that's where a tendency to react with anger and jealousy and dislike has a lot of negative effects on our body and health. So the idea here is that can we learn to develop greater sense of connectedness with the people that we interact, whether they are our friends and family members or strangers, or maybe even sometimes people who are not particularly nice to us. That is there something that we can, you know, can we change our perspective about them, and can we relate to them with a sense of kind of positivity instead of that negative sense? And if we can change our perspective about them and be able to relate to them with greater positivity and connectedness, does that then translate to a better health and a, you know, better state of our mind, more peaceful and more healthy and a happy state of the mind? And that's what I think that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and you know, any other spiritual tradition will argue, that it maintains that compassion, love and compassion, I mean, these are the qualities that are really the foundations for our health and well-being, and not just personal, but in the communal well-being. And these are the qualities that one can cultivate, one can train and enhance, and the meditations are designed as a way to develop those inborn qualities that we all have the ability to learn and develop.
What you're saying makes me realize that probably when most of us react with negativity or with the fight or flight response, it would be better if we didn't. Every once in a while, there, for example, recently a couple of little children had abduction attempts against them, and both of them screamed and ran away and really defended themselves, and that was a very good thing to do. If they'd reacted with compassion, they probably would have been kidnapped. But most of the time, it's appropriate, or would just be better for ourselves and our health and our society, if we reacted in a way that had less animosity. Now, my question is, when you have practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism who have been practicing for a very long time, do they ever lose that ability to defend themselves when they really need to?
Well, I think, I mean, you're raising a really very important question. I mean, whether learning to be more compassionate and loving, does that mean that, you know, we lose our objectivity and that we lose the perspective of what is detrimental to us? And I think that there is a fine distinction that one needs to make. It's not that the training in meditation would make one just simply, you know, take everything as beautiful and nice and that nothing wrong. What in Tibetan we say is that compassion needs to be accompanied with wisdom. So one can see what is negative and harmful to one And one can avoid that, you know, without becoming overly kind of the emotionally reacting to that. But I agree that this fight or flight response, the stress response by itself is not a bad thing. That when there are real dangers where we have to be able to, you know, have enough kind of energy to run away or to be able to handle it. But I think that what we are seeing here is that in living with a tremendous kind of the psychosocial stress in today's world, the next door neighbor or the workplace, your boss or coworker, I mean, that's not necessarily there to kill us. But right. Unfortunately, very often, we react to them with this kind of a sense of a negativity as if they are almost like, you know, life-threatening as something in the nature, so like the tigers and so forth and so on. Not necessarily cognitively, but emotionally, that that kind of the stress response kicks in. And that's what is becomes detrimental. I think that day in and out, if we were to live relating to others or reacting to others as if they are really there to destroy us, that becomes very destructive, you know, this prolonged stress is very destructive for our health. It depletes our energy, and all kinds of the health problems are created by this chronic and prolonged stress.
If it were true, as many scientists do believe, that consciousness arises entirely from the brain, then some of the basic premises of Buddhism would be impossible, one being the continuation of consciousness past death and before birth. Do you have a way in your explanation of both Buddhist and scientific studies to explain the medium or mechanism in which consciousness exists outside of the physical brain and the physical body?
That is where I think that the science and the Buddhism have fundamental difference. I think that this basic paradigm that whether the mind or the consciousness is limited to the function of the brain or the nervous system, or whether the mind can survive the brain death. In Buddhist tradition, you know, certainly maintains that the while our coarse emotional and mental conscious, you know, activities of the mind, these are, while they are very much dependent on the brain as well as, you know, various biochemicals and one may call the energies, but they are not limited to the functions of the brain or the biochemicals. But Buddhist tradition maintains that there are subtler states of mind or the consciousness that are independent of, that can kind of function independently of this coarse, you know, physical activities. And it explains that the mind at the subtler levels connected with what may be called subtle energy, and that energy-mind complex can actually exist beyond brain death or the physical death. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I mean, this is something I think that scientifically, I don't know how successful we will be to measure that, but in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I mean, it is well known that there are advanced meditators who, after their clinical death, you know, after their death clinically, when they are declared death, they still remain in certain post-death meditation called Thugdam in Tibetan, heart meditation, where their bodies do not decay for days. It's sometimes even for several weeks. We just had a very high Tibetan Lama die last year, and you know, it's one of the former lineage holders of Tibetan Gelug School of Tibetan Buddhism. He was in post-death meditation for 17 days. And the person in that state is dead, but certainly his body remains very much, it doesn't lose its certain glow, and it doesn't decay. You know, that the moment that when the person comes out of that tukdam, you know, that post-death meditation, actually the body immediately begins to deteriorate and people have to cremate or, you know, to remove immediately. But as long as they are in that post-death meditation, that it can go on for weeks. And so that Buddhist tradition takes that as one of the indications of the mind surviving the brain death. And then, you know, the whole phenomenon about the reincarnation, the people who come with certain memories of the past lives, and there is a whole tradition in Tibetan Buddhist tradition to recognize these young tulkus, reincarnate lamas, who not necessarily everyone, but certainly there are plenty of those young kids who are the reincarnation of the high lamas. They report certain memories of their past lives. They seem to confirm the information of their past lives. So these are the kind of things that I think that the Buddhist tradition would rely upon to maintain the position that the mind survives the death. Of course, that from the scientific perspective, you know, that is something that would be terribly hard to measure and validate. I think it was Daniel Goleman who wrote the Emotional Intelligence and Social Intelligence. I mean, the best-selling author of these books, that in one of his books, I think it was in Emotional Intelligence, where he talks about that, how this, the modern science and Buddhism, when it comes to the origin of mind, they have just this difference in the basic paradigm. And what would that mean if any one of these, you know, like whether that there is a very conclusive kind of demonstration that mind begins, you know, with a certain physical property. What would that mean for Buddhist? On the other hand, if there is a clear demonstration of the mind surviving the physical death, then what would that mean to the science? I mean, it will have to just drastically revise the entire system.
Right, right. When I read about how meditation is good for the immune system and things like that, I think of something that I once heard from a meditation teacher. He had terrible migraine headaches and no doctor could cure him, and finally, in desperation, he went to a meditation center, but the teacher wouldn't teach him if his only reason was to cure his headaches. He had to commit to studying in order to achieve enlightenment and nothing less. Do you think that it's important to have a higher goal when one takes up the study of meditation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, if you think the meditation basically being, you know, a process of enhancing certain skills or qualities, let's say mindfulness or compassion, it doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, limited for those who are committed to full enlightenment or liberation. I think that these qualities, like being more compassionate, certainly is good for our society, for families, you know, that the people who live around a person who is compassionate and loving, I mean, that certainly, you know, they benefit. And then for one's own health and well-being, you know, it's, of course, it's everyone's kind of right to, you know, find any tools that will provide that opportunity for better health and the happiness. So I don't think that it's necessary. But by the same token, I think that the very nature of compassion or the mindfulness and like this certainly need to be approached from a little bit broader perspective, not just simply from this selfish me perspective, that what is there for me. I think that that is a very antithesis of the compassion itself. If one approaches this, that just again from that egocentric or self-centered perspective, that's not compassion. So,
right.
You know, that it is for better health and well-being. I mean, that if the people can, you know, see the need to really value and to appreciate and to connect with others in that spirit, if they can do that, by all means, I think that it is good for them and good for others.
So meditation practices can change individuals, as you've seen, as we've been talking about. What about entire societies? I was wondering if Tibetan society historically was shaped by the understandings of Buddhist practice and maybe what some of the social institutions and practices outside the monastery might have been that were shaped by compassion meditation?
Well, I think that when these ideals, like the compassion and so forth, when they become the foundation of the policies, you know, the law and the governance in certain society or country, certainly that it will contribute to the greater harmony and peace and well-being of the population there. In Tibet, it's not to say that Tibet, before the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 59, was a perfect society. I mean, that, you know, it's like any other human society. I mean, it has had its good part and bad part too. But by and large, I think that the Tibetan society in Tibet before 1959 was very much informed by the Buddhist principles of love and compassion and the equal rights and all those things. And very different than the one we have now under the Chinese Communist rule. I was just reading the other day an article written by one of the young Tibetan scholar about the nature conservancy in Tibet, informed by the Buddhist ideals for concern for all beings, like the birds and the animals, and how the hunting and so forth and so on was prohibited at certain times. And so I think that in a society when those principles are the kind of the guiding force, it can certainly contribute to greater peace and harmony. I went to see a movie yesterday about Nelson Mandela, Invictus, I think it's called, just came out. And it's incredible how one person's embracing of the compassion and the restraint and the virtue, you know, that this, the one person's vision of the country, the society that is based on equal respect for all and, you know, forgiveness, how it transformed a country, I mean, that which was at the verge of social unrest or at the verge of that kind of split. But one person, I mean, that his vision, and when he incorporated that in the way that he governed the country, how it brought all those people together, that it contributed to a tremendous sense of harmony and peace.
Geshe Lobsang Tenzin, I want to thank you so much for being with us here today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And once again, Geshe Lobsang Tenzin will be giving a workshop from 3 to 5 on Saturday, December 19th, The Healing Power of Compassion, Insights from the Convergence of Modern Science and Buddhist Science of Mind. You can register with the monks at the Mandala Sand Painting Exhibition at Surrett and Sons Gallery at 121 Sandoval Street in Santa Fe. Or call Marcia Keegan at 505-989-9590 for more information. I'm very happy now to welcome documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. His latest film is called La Danse, and it opens this Friday, the 18th of December, at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
So this is a fascinating 2.5-hour documentary about the Paris Opera Ballet, and it shows so much of what goes into the actual making of a number of different ballets. How did you choose the subject, both the ballet itself and this particular ballet company?
Well, I'm a fan of ballet. I mean, I've been going to the ballet for years, and in 1992 I made another ballet movie about the American Ballet Theater. And the last 7 or 8 years, I've been living half to three-quarters of the year in Paris in connection with other projects that I've done there, and I just thought it was time to make another ballet movie, mainly because I'm a fan and I like living in Paris, and it's a great dance company.
It's an incredible dance company. The you show so many of the rehearsals in the studios of the ballet school, the ballet company, and I thought it was so interesting in how it showed that the magic that you see on stage when you go to the ballet is really hard won. It's constructed. I mean, even the greatest dancers don't necessarily look so good in the early rehearsals.
No, they have to work very, very hard. And, you know, it's work that's actually started for most of them when they're 6 years old. And they have to keep at it every day. I mean, there are 150 dancers at the Paris Opera Ballet, and every day they go to class in the morning, they have rehearsals in the afternoon, and a goodly number of them dance at night. And the director of the ballet, in one of the scenes in the movie, you may recall, she said a ballet dancer is half nun and half boxer.
I love that.
Yeah, I did too, actually.
You don't use titles or voiceovers or interviews or narrators or any techniques like that that are used in a lot of documentary films. And as a result, the viewer who's never really heard of the Paris Opera Ballet or never seen them or its stars doesn't have any idea who's who. And it's, I kind of like that because you're not spoon-fed what you're supposed to be looking for. So there's a sense of discovery on the part of the viewer.
That's exactly my view. It's not who, it's what.
Yeah. And was that your own experience as in making the film, that you were also kind of discovering it as you
exactly.
went along?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people who know the dance world know who the ballet dancers are. People who don't know the dance world, the fact that you give a name is meaningless. So what the movie asks you to do is to have a look at what you're seeing and make your own judgment about what you're seeing.
You also show us that the ballet is constructed from the work of so many people. So we see the costume makers and the lighting designers and the administrators and the wall painters and everybody, even the people who pick up the trash after the performance. And it felt like a kind of loving and inclusive portrait of the whole system.
As far as I'm concerned, that's exactly what it is. It's a love letter to the Paris Opera Ballet.
That's wonderful. It's just so different. I have to ask you something, because at one point there's a scene of a beekeeper. Mm-hmm. What was his role?
Well, he was a retired technician. He was a stagehand, and he liked to keep bees, and he asked the administrator for permission to keep bees on the roof. And when I heard about it, I thought it'd make a nice scene.
Oh, okay. I was thinking maybe there's the wax that is used somehow in the costumes, and I just hadn't put it together or something.
No. In fact, they sell the honey that he collects there in the boutique in the store of the Paris Opera Ballet. It's expensive, but you can buy honey from the Paris Opera Ballet.
So the film also makes the viewer, made me think about the younger and older generations. The speakers in the film are mostly the directors and choreographers who were former dancers, and then the dancers are mostly silent. And
yeah, well, that's the way they were. I mean, during rehearsals, there wasn't much. During rehearsal, people can't talk. I mean, even the people that are hanging around can't talk because it would interfere with the rehearsal. When the rehearsal's over, they take off. I mean, there wasn't much conversation.
Right. I guess what I felt from it, and maybe I think the way you make your films, everybody is going to go home with something different and maybe very different, one person to the next. But I really was so struck by the sense that you got of how much work goes into passing knowledge down from one generation to another.
Exactly. That's one of the things the film's about. It's exactly right. Because the ballet masters and even some of the choreographers were former star dancers. They in turn are passing, for instance, Laurent Hilaire, who is the ballet master for a number of the ballets in the film. He was a star dancer at the company for about 25 years. He in turn went to the ballet school that's run by the opera. He was taught by stars of another generation. So, within four or five classes of the ballet school, you're already back in the 19th century. And so there's a continuity of tradition that is inherent in the situation, because most of the dancers, not all of them, but most of them have been to the ballet school of the company, where they have been trained by former dancers at the company, who in their turn, 25 years before, were trained by former dancers at the company.
And it also ends up, at least for me, being about the transience of those few years of strength and beauty that those dancers have before they then take their place as teachers or go on and do other things.
That's exactly the point of view of the film. because it is, what they create is so beautiful. It's transient, and each performance is different. And it's when it works, it's extraordinarily beautiful, and then it's gone.
How long did you spend shooting this film?
12 weeks, and then it took me about 13 months to edit it.
So you had hundreds of hours of footage that you were working with?
130.
Right, right. When you were editing, what was guiding you? How did you make decisions about what to keep and how to construct the film?
Oh, well, the first thing I do is look at all the rushes. And then I pick the... I edit the rushes, the sequences that interest me. And it's only after I've done all that that I begin to work on the structure. Because I never work on the structure in the abstract. I have to, you know, I have to try out how things fit together. And so I usually don't do any work at all on the structure until I'm maybe 6 or 7 months into the editing. And I've edited all the candidate sequences into some kind of usable form. And then I can do the first assembly of the film in 3 or 4 days, because at that point I know the material inside out, and I can make the changes quickly. And then after that, it takes a while. That first version comes out to usually a half an hour or 40 minutes longer than the final version. But what I do when I've got that first assembly is then work on the rhythm, the internal rhythm within a sequence and the external rhythm between the sequences.
The film is so long. It's over 2.5 hours long. I know that you've shown many of your works on PBS. This film, do they edit it down, or does,
no,
is it
no,
shown
no,
in its entirety?
No, 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 I never let anybody. No, this, when this film is broadcast on television, it will be shown in exactly the form you saw it.
That's very heartening to know.
No, I don't, nobody, I don't give permission to anybody to ever cut my film.
What,
and I don't cut them.
Yeah.
They come out at the length they're made, and that's it. You know, it's basically take it or leave it.
You allow us in this film, La Danse, to see the context of the ballet in Paris. And I was thinking, and maybe you can enlighten us more about this since you made a film about ABT, but while some of the issues that dancers and administrators and so on are dealing with would probably be the same in any ballet company in the world, there were also moments where it seemed like the people in the company were really respected as artists in France, in Paris, rather than marginalized and kind of on their own as they are here in the U.S. I wondered if you could comment on that.
I think that's true, because, first of all, the French back up their interest in culture with money. I think 1% of the national budget in France goes for cultural activities. So that the Paris Opera Ballet gets a subsidy every year. It doesn't cover all their costs because it's dependent on box office too, but they're pretty well, the ballet is always sold out, and the theater is over 2,000 seats. Unlike some American ballet companies, they know that they're going to continue from year to year. They're not going. When I was at the ABT, there was, you know, it was an issue how many dances they would have the following year and what their budget would be and whether the foundations or the wealthy donors would come through. And that's true of many American ballet companies, because there's very little subsidized support that people can count on over a long period of time. And so that makes an enormous difference in terms of both planning and hiring. And another difference is that the Paris Opera Ballet has a tradition. A company like the ABT, which is a very good dance company, nevertheless gets dancers from all over the world who have all been trained in different ways. Whereas the Paris Opera Ballet, most of the dancers are trained in the school of the Paris Opera Ballet. So those two things make for significant differences in the nature of the company.
The film shows that sense of hard, incredibly hard work and creativity and profound artistic exploration, which pops up in all sorts of moments and all sorts of ways, and discipline and focus, and they all pay off. And there's this performance footage. I don't know if it's dress rehearsal, but it's on the stage, or whether it's actual performance footage. And you give us long shots as if we were true audience members.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of it's performance and some of it's dress rehearsal. But that's performance. Dress rehearsals are where everyone goes full out at the dress rehearsal.
And so you really let us be an audience member sitting in the seats.
Right, but I had a real advantage. I could shoot from the stage. So the perspective, with one or two short exceptions, the perspective is all from the side of the stage. I was really very, very close. And that's why you can hear the footsteps. I mean, the movie wasn't shot from the front row of the theater. The movie was shot from the, most of the performance was shot from the side of the stage. So we were really close to the dancers. And it was a different, the perspective is different than the traditional perspective from the front of the theater.
There's a lot of shooting that happened in rehearsals, and then the artistic director we see many times throughout the film. Did you have to have the cameras rolling for long enough that they kind of overcame self-consciousness of having cameras pointed at them?
No,
or how does that work?
No, for reasons that I don't understand, it was no different with them than anybody else. Any other subject, people don't object to being photographed. And, you know, you can use material from the first 5 minutes you're there. There's no difference in the quality of the material you get in the first 5 minutes or the 56th day.
Interesting. I'm surprised. Although not from the rehearsal point of view, because dancers are used to being watched, so I suppose it doesn't matter whether they're being watched by camera or by audiences.
But I mean, it's equally true of the meetings. That's my experience, not just with the ballet films, but with any film.
For
reasons that I don't understand, most people, 99.9% of people, don't object to being photographed and just go about their business, which is great. That's what you want.
It is indeed. I wonder if that's the attitude that you bring to it yourself, of somehow not being too in their face. I mean,
well, I try to, you know, not to be aggressive or intrusive. But I'm right there. And I do what I can to demystify the process. And I try not to be threatening in any way. And I explain to people who are interested what's going on. But there are a variety of possible explanations. Narcissism is an explanation. Narcissism, vanity, the fact that I don't present myself in a threatening way. But it's all speculative. I mean, the true answer is I don't really know why. But the fact of the matter is it's never a problem about people either acting for the camera or refusing to be photographed. For instance, nobody in the course of the ballet movie refused to be photographed. And that's generally, I mean, maybe one or two people in the course of the film and some of the other films have said no, but most, 99.9% of the people just go ahead and do what they're doing.
When you say that, what I think of is, well, they've got nothing to hide. And one of the things that I just really loved and felt curious about was the fact that no matter how hard they're working and no matter how tough the corrections are on the part of the directors and choreographers toward the dancers, there's still this love and respect and support that seems to be there all the time.
Yeah, that was terrific. I mean, they weren't cruel, and they were direct, but they weren't cruel.
Which is not what you think of from some of those old, I mean, even for me as a child, some of those old Russian ballet mistresses who
you're
terrified of.
Yeah, well, they were another cup of tea, I think.
Now, have you shown this film in France?
Yeah, it's playing in France. It opened in France on the 4th of October. It opened at 8 theaters in Paris on the 4th of October, and it was very well received there, and a lot of people are going to see it.
I suppose the audience for a film like this in France would really reflect the greater emphasis that the French give to their arts.
Well, there's a lot of interest in ballet. I mean, the film has done very well in America, wherever it's played, which I'm pleased to... in Japan, and it's been very, very successful in Japan.
Frederick Wiseman is a documentary filmmaker, and the new film is called La Danse. It's about the Paris Opera Ballet, and it opens this coming Friday at the Santa Fe, at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Is there any chance that you will come out here at all?
Unfortunately not. I'm busy trying to finish up another film.
What's your next film about?
It's about boxing.
Ah, so part nun, part boxer.
Right. Well, I've done a monastery already, but I haven't done a convent.
Well, we look forward to that, and thank you so much for being with us on KSFR.
Thank you for doing the interview. It was a good one. I appreciate it.
Thanks to you.
All right, bye.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte, broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Stay tuned for the BBC, local news, and then the jazz experience. Thank you.